Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Hey, that's me. You've arrived at Green Sense, where we are at the intersection of common sense and economic sense, and Bob Kessler helps us make Green Sense with the guests that he finds every week. Bob, who are we going
to
meet?
This is a guy you tipped me off to, Robert. The Biosphere 2. Remember this from the early 90s? People were sealed up in this self-contained indoor ecosystem, and they were going to see how that went. So just find out what it would be like to live in space. You remember all this, early 90s, right?
I do. And when I first heard it, I thought it would be a really cool experiment, and I wanted to be one of those eight people.
Yeah, well, it didn't go so well. But they kept the facility, and it's been transformed into a center for research and learning about ecosystems and the environment. So we have the deputy director of the Biosphere 2 to tell us all about what's happening there. And Sarah Gutterman, our friend from Green Builder Media, will give us the latest on sustainability in the built environment.
All coming up on this edition of Green Sense. How we approach the built environment, from the materials used to the energy saved in building and operating them, to how we reuse and recycle materials at the end of a building's life cycle, are all critical to making sustainable communities. Sarah Gutterman is CEO of Green Builder Media and joins us now on Green Sense. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Well, we haven't talked for a while, so look forward to getting an update. And one of the issues that we've been covering for a while here on Green Sense is water. And one aspect we have not covered is water and green buildings. And I pulled up just a little data from the U.S. Energy and Information Administration, and they had a report that said that of 46,000 large commercial buildings, that's greater than 200,000 square feet, that they used about 359 billion gallons of water, 980 million gallons a day in 2012. Wow, I had no idea that buildings consume that much water. So what do you have to share with us on how we make buildings more sustainable when it comes to conserving water?
Yeah, it's such a great question because water is absolutely the topic of our moment. We've kind of already solved for energy efficiency, and renewables. And so now we really have to turn our attention to water. And water is so important in the built environment because if there's no water, there are no building permits, period. So it's the number one potential limiting factor to growth. Fortunately, there's a lot of ways to solve for water in terms of water innovations, for example, water conserving and low flow plumbing fixtures. There's a huge growth in leak detection and water monitoring systems that learn the water footprint of a home or a building and shut off water when leaks are detected, as well as gray water systems for water recycling.
Sarah, are there any techniques that allow either gray water or recycled water to be used to water the surrounding landscape?
Yeah, that's actually exactly what gray water systems do. They utilize water from within the home, they recycle and filter them, and then they bring them back inside for non-potable uses like toilets and other non-potable uses. But the majority of the gray water systems are then actually used for exterior irrigation systems. So gray water in conjunction with smart irrigation systems that can measure soil moisture and weather conditions to use water when it's needed and turn the systems off when it's not needed is a really great way to conserve water on exterior and irrigation applications, which frankly is actually the majority of water use in homes.
One of the things that I'm seeing out there, and I'm not sure if it's intended to help improve conservation techniques, but it's impact or connection fees. There's especially out west, there's very large costs when you hook up a water or a sewer system. Any thoughts or how that plays into water conservation?
Yeah, great question again. So we are actually seeing a lot of changes in water codes, policy mandates, and pricing. And you're hitting the nail on the head. with water pricing. And in fact, we'll use one example. Santa Fe, New Mexico has the most stringent water policies and the highest water prices, but they also have the lowest daily per capita water usage in the country at about 87 gallons per day. So as an example, Las Vegas is one of the next lowest per capita water users at about 200 gallons per day. And that's because of water pricing. So we're actually starting to see around the country in places like Westminster, Colorado, or Fort Collins, Colorado, we're starting to see really high tap fees, you know, these hookup fees that you're talking about, which is actually forcing builders and developers to be really innovative about how they're treating water and how they're conserving water by using some of those water innovations we just mentioned.
We've talked for a long time on the show on the best way to really curb water use is to raise water prices. Now, that's easy to say, but nobody wants to pay those higher impact fees or wants to pay more for water. But the examples you gave really illustrate that as water becomes more expensive, people get more conservative about that. So do you see that as a trend in other cities picking those higher fees up?
Absolutely. And you know what? It's actually high time that we start charging appropriate rates for water. We haven't been. We've been subsidizing our water use. And so people just, you know, figure that water comes from the tap and it's going to come out, you know, when they want it and when they want to use it. I think we're going to start seeing a lot of movement towards higher pricing for water, which frankly is a move towards appropriately pricing that water. What we're also seeing in addition to that higher pricing is we're starting to see some building moratoriums because of water in really unexpected places like Bainbridge Island, right off of Seattle, where you wouldn't think they'd have water issues, but they've had building moratoriums because of lack of access to clean water. So we are going to start seeing over the course of the next several years a lot of changes in the water sector.
Sarah, any new cool technologies coming out that help conserve water?
Well, I really love the leak detection and water monitoring systems that I mentioned earlier that learn the water footprint of a home or building and can be proactive in terms of sending alerts if it detects increased water usage, let's say at a faucet, which may indicate a leak. And then it can shut off water to a house or a building if it does detect a leak. So there's some cool companies out there. One is called Finn, which is a joint venture between Belkin and Uponor. Another one is called Flow, actually Flow by Moen, because Moen has just partnered with Flow. So we're starting to see a lot of movement in that space, which I think is going to be very impactful. The other really cool, somewhat esoteric technology that I'm watching is atmospheric generators. These are being used a lot in like the Caribbean and in island applications, and certainly in climates that are more humid where it makes sense to do this, but basically they take water out of the air and provide that water to a home or a building. We're actually doing, we're going to test a system in a Vision House demonstration project that Green Builder Media is constructing in the Seattle market, which again is an appropriate climate because it's humid enough.
Yeah, it's a great idea. It solves two problems. It reduces humidity and creates water. What about appliances? Toilets, dishwashers, washing machines, have those all been moving towards low flow use?
Yes, and they will continue to get more and more water conserving, I believe. Appliances as well as plumbing fixtures, they have certain, there are certain regulations that are continuing to ratchet up in terms of water use, and those regulations, again, will continue to be enhanced and increased to save water through those applications and products and technologies.
Well, water is such a vast topic. We could continue talking about this for hours, but we appreciate your insight and sharing your thoughts on the subject. And we'll look forward to having you back on the show in a couple of weeks with an update on indoor air quality.
Fantastic.
That's Sarah Gutterman, CEO of Green Builder Media. Check out their articles at greenbuildermedia.com. I'm Robert Colangelo, and you can subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Biosphere 2, originally built as a self-contained ecosystem to research how to maintain life in outer space, grabbed a lot of headlines when it first came into existence in the early 90s. Since that time, it's been taken over by the University of Arizona as a place for research and education. We're joined now by John Adams, Deputy Director of Biosphere 2. John, welcome to GreenSense.
How are you all doing?
Well, I've got to start with the most obvious question. Where's Biosphere 1?
Well, I mean, that's probably one of the number one questions we get from people who visit the facility. And Biosphere 1 is the Earth. And the remarkable thing is the people who built Biosphere 2 specifically named it such for people to ask that question, where is Biosphere 1? Because they want everything to come back to people thinking about the Earth.
And maybe we could continue on that history of Biospheres 2, as starting with the 1991 through 1993 grand experiment to the present and how the University of Arizona became involved with its operation.
Yeah, and let me put a little things in context for those who have never visited. So the structure covers a little over 3 acres. So it's almost 3 football fields in length in the north-south axis. But, you know, we had a group of folks really sort of ahead of their times, late 80s, early 90s, who embarked on a journey to build a self-contained environment. For the purpose, as you mentioned, for understanding could we colonize the moon or Mars, but more fundamentally, what didn't capture the headlines was to understand Earth systems. And so in September of 91, 8 people were sealed inside this facility for 2 years. I think many of us have heard about the trials and tribulations, and a lot of people will refer to that first closure period where these 8 people lived inside as a failure. But for anybody who's done experiments, we know that doing experiments, things happen contrary to what we anticipate. And so you may want to, you know, some people may call that a failure, but in actuality, it's not, because we learn so much more from things that happen, not as we initially hypothesize, but as we don't hypothesize. Because if it happens just as we predict, then we really haven't learned anything other than to say, well, we knew that that was going to happen. And that's exactly how the scenario played out for them inside. And they had challenges atmospherically. They had challenge producing enough food to support the 8 people that were inside. And as has been well documented by many different agencies, they had social and psychological challenges of living in a confined, sealed space with the same group of people for such a long period of time.
So, John, as you said, science is all about learning and proving what doesn't work and what does. And we learn best really from our failures. So what were the best lessons learned and the takeaways from the grand experiment?
Yeah, I think probably even today, in my opinion, the most important lesson learned from Biosphere 2 is how little we truly understand Earth systems, just how infinitely complex they are. And, you know, even though Biosphere 2 was originally designed as a closed system to in part mimic or replicate that which you find on Earth, Earth is a closed system. I mean, we don't think of it oftentimes in that context, but everything that we do ultimately, as those types of impacts grow, are going to change the dynamics of the Earth itself. The only difference with Biosphere 2 is it's significantly smaller. So anytime you do something inside, it's going to have an impact. It's just that impact you see almost immediately. And that's what became very apparent for those folks living inside. And so that lesson, I think, again, is just to reflect and understand how infinitely complex our systems are, how little we truly understand. And as much as we like to romanticize about going to the moon or Mars, the likelihood that that's going to happen for a large number of us, I think, is extremely slim until well into the future. And so understanding Earth, being able to anticipate those changes coming up, being able to produce enough food for the growing population is going to be critical if we're going to survive.
So from 1991 to 1993, the 8 people lived in the Biosphere 2, and they went through some experimentation. Then what happened?
Well, so what ended up happening is sort of classically, as organizations grow and emphasis and priorities begin to shift, one of the challenges for them is they were not, in my opinion, and as I interpret what initially happened, is they weren't forthcoming with the challenges they were faced inside. In particular, oxygen got very low. It got down to 14.2%. They had to add oxygen in. They didn't initially disclose this to the media. In fact, they tried to not disclose that. And when it came out contrary, and they had to retract some of those statements, that really significantly hurt their credibility. So this credibility loss with the scientific community, the public, and the press, the fact that there was extreme overruns and expenses led the person who originally put forward the finances to build the facility to sort of look closely and say, okay, we need to change the direction of the facility. So he brought in a different management group in April of 1994. That group removed the sitting group. They came in and really started to look at repurposing Biosphere 2 as an Earth and Environmental Science laboratory, because some folks from Columbia University, a guy by the name of Wally Broker, who just recently passed, but world-renowned geochemist, a person who's really pioneered and started this thinking about climate change as a whole, a guy by the name of Michael Crow, who's now president of Arizona State University, they saw the unique opportunities of Biosphere 2 to do experiments and large manipulative experiments unlike any facility that we currently had, and really help to bridge the gap between what people do in the lab and what we observe in the field. And so that started the transition. And in 1996, Columbia University officially took over. They were here for about 8 years, but as often happens, you have an administrative change. And Mike Crow went to be president of Arizona State University. Some other folks left, the sitting president, and it's a difficult facility to manage and maintain, especially if your home institution is 3,000 miles away. So ultimately, they returned the facility. And long story short, the University of Arizona, under the guidance of Joaquin Ruiz, who's the dean of the College of Science, stepped forward in 2007 and assumed initially management, but they actually now own the facility and have continued to move forward with using it as a large earth and environmental science laboratory.
So, John, tell me, what kind of experiments are going on there currently?
Yeah. So Biosphere, even in its early history, has had some remarkable experiments, which we continue to build on. So the ocean system inside was one of the first places to show this connection between increasing atmospheric CO2 and decreased coral growth. And so some early experiments in our ocean system show that once you get to 400 parts per million, which is what the sea, we're, you know, at 411 right now, atmospherically. When I started at Biosphere over 20 years ago, just for our listeners to give them a perspective, it was 365. So we're continuing to see this uptick. And as you get more CO2 in the atmosphere, it's a gas that's soluble in water. As it dissolves into the ocean water, it changes the chemistry in a way that is actually not favorable for corals to grow. You reduce their calcification rate. And so we hear it commonly referred to as ocean acidification. Those experiments were first done in the Biosphere 2 ocean. We are building on that today. We've got new faculty who have come in under the leadership of a person by the name of Dr. Diane Thompson. And what she is doing is she's now going through and revamping our ocean. She has put together a team of 39 international partners, and they really see our ocean as a unique opportunity to continue to build on the ability to do experiments. And these experiments, really, one of our collaborators, I think, puts it really well. Things that you're afraid to do in nature, you can do inside Biosphere 2 first. And so they want to use our ocean system to test the resiliency of corals and potentially new types of corals or selected breeding stocks of corals to hopefully be able to give them an opportunity to survive these increasing coastal temperatures that we're seeing and these decreasing pH or this increase in ocean acidification that we're seeing.
So one of the most important things in science is funding. You know, without funding, you can't do research. So how is Biosphere 2 funded?
Yeah, so Biosphere 2, we're really fortunate. The person who originally put forward the finances to build Biosphere 2, and remember, late 80s, early 90s, the estimated construction cost for this and some of those early operating costs, $250 million. So if you put that in today's dollars, you know, we've got, with inflation, approaching a billion. So Ed Bass has continued to provide some support. We get visitors who come through, and we have a small conference center that provides some additional support. And then we also get a little bit of support from the University of Arizona. So the combined or the combination of those help to provide Biosphere 2 with its base operational budget. And then we get some traditional grants like other institutions or labs that are at universities would traditionally get.
John, what's an average day look like at Biosphere 2?
Well, you know, an average day is really a diverse day in the sense that we have visitors that come through and they want to see this architectural iconic structure. They want to hear a little bit about the history and what we're doing today. We then have teams who continue to work to maintain the facility. As you can imagine, its mechanical systems are extensive, and you know we're always having to do things to keep it in its optimal running performance. And then, for example, right now we've got a group of about 30 international researchers, folks from Germany, Austria, Switzerland, England. They're getting ready to do a large research campaign in our rainforest. So in our rainforest system, they're actually going to give it a drought. We are doing some interesting and sort of novel labeling techniques in our system to look at how this entire system responds to a drought. How does it allocate water resources? Which plants suffer first? How does carbon move or not move through the system? And so they're really excited because things that they can't sort of trace outside, they can begin to trace inside, but within a complex community like the tropical rainforest we have inside Biosphere 2. So it's really diverse from the public to very, you know, traditional science going on.
With this intended to help promote finding and better understanding how humans can live in space, how come NASA is not involved?
Well, you know, that's a great question. You know, early on, NASA sort of took a step back and sort of watched what was happening. And I wasn't here during then, so I don't understand all of those dynamics. Now, today, really for the past 20 or so years, the emphasis hasn't been on space colonization at all. And again, early on, even though that captured the headlines, that was not a primary emphasis. A facility like this and of its size is unlikely that we will ever build anything like that on the moon or Mars. What we're going to end up putting, if we do ultimately make it to one of these locations, is they're going to be much smaller in size. And so some of the research we're doing in some of our sections, we're actually collaborating, is much like what you do in some of your facilities. We're looking at ways that you can grow plants in a very confined space, use those plants to recycle the CO2 that we exhale, to produce oxygen that we need to inhale, to actually then recycle water, to grow crops that are going to at least partially support the calorie needs of people living inside. But all of this is going to occur in a much, much smaller system. And so for us, it's really twofold. We're working with folks in the Controlled Environments and Agriculture Center on this side. That would be potentially for space application. The stuff that's going on inside Biosphere 2 proper really is to try to better understand and give scientists improved tools to predict how systems outside that we're all dependent on are going to change as we move into the future and we see decreased moisture, increased CO2 in regions around the world.
John, I could go on talking to you for days. This is such a interesting and engaging topic. I'm really happy that I will be down there in a couple of weeks. I've always wanted to visit, so we'll have to pick up an interview maybe after my visit, and I've seen some things. But thank you for joining us on GreenSense, and we wish you the best of luck there.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and we look forward to seeing you here at Biosphere 2 and showing you everything that we've talked about today.
Great. That's John Adams, Deputy Director of Biosphere 2, at the University of Arizona, joining us on GreenSense. I'm Robert Colangelo, and you can subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of GreenSense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.